So this is session number 204, Learning the Hard Way, National Disaster Preparedness Initiatives. My name is Amay Primo, and I am the Special Projects Coordinator at the Northeast Document Conservation Center in Andover, Massachusetts. So when I was putting this panel together, I realized that it never fails. With all disasters come the lessons learned. Most of us discovered a long time ago that sometimes the only way to actually learn a lesson is to do it the hard way. Certainly this was true for town clerks along the Mississippi Gulf Coast after Katrina, librarians at the University of Hawaii at Manoa after the mudslide of 2004, and archivists in New York State after last year's torrential rains. Disasters cause cultural institutions and organizations across the country to reassess the way they prepare for emergencies. And the last few years have been especially active. Lessons learned panels have proliferated at conferences, allowing us to learn from other people's experiences. But all too often, the excitement about emergency preparedness wanes, and the hard lessons are relegated to a few notes jotted down in the back of a program at a glance. This session today is designed to let you know that the conversation has not stopped. There are several organizations represented here today that are taking those lessons learned and turning them into initiatives that will better prepare the culture community for future emergencies and disasters. Each of us here today come from an organization that are well prepared to help educate and make emergency preparedness a reality for cultural organizations and institutions across the country. I'll introduce our speakers in a moment, but I wanted to say a few brief words about why I'm here as chair of this panel. As I said, I'm the special projects coordinator at what we know as NEDCC, the Northeast Document Conservation Center. Outside of the conservation work that's done in our lab, NEDCC has long had an active role in the preservation community through its field service office, of which I'm a part. We conduct workshops, conferences, and surveys, as well as manage grant-funded projects which develop tools to designed to help staff of cultural institutions create, just to help staff of cultural institutions. DPLAN, one of these tools, is an online disaster planning tool, and it is designed to help staff create a disaster plan. Staff members create a login, they enter in information specific to their institution, click print, and a PDF version of their disaster plan is generated for them, all of this free of charge. While this sounds simple, DPLAN is extremely thorough, and the program creates a very comprehensive disaster plan. There are currently over 1,300 institutions with DPLAN accounts and over 1,600 individual logins. DPLAN has been so successful that we are creating a DPLAN Lite, in which you fill out only 25 of the most important questions, but still have what we would call a disaster plan at the end of that process. For the moment, it does remain free of charge for all users, and hopefully that will continue. The latest project that we're working on at NEDCC is a statewide disaster planning initiative. We are partnering with other regional centers, the Massachusetts Board of Library Commissioners, and the Massachusetts State Archives to create a guide that states can use to create a statewide disaster plan for cultural resources. This guide will not be a fill-in-the-blank template, but rather a guide organized around meetings with cultural heritage staff and emergency responders alike. This guide will lead people through the process of writing a statewide plan. As any of you know who work at state agencies or have worked with state agencies in the past, all of them are extremely different in each state. And so this guide has to be adaptable for every state. Also, statewide planning is much different than institutional planning. So that's another thing that we're dealing with is what those differences are and making sure that they're all covered. We're currently working with an advisory committee using some of the initiatives that will be discussed here today to help create this model and then test it in Massachusetts with the Massachusetts Board of Library Commissioners, and the Massachusetts State Archives. After creating a statewide plan in Massachusetts, the guide will be available to all states. The advisory committee, I should say, consists of representatives from the cultural heritage community. So on our panel here today, they're all represented. And emergency response, people from the emergency response community across the country. Now, I really could stand up here and talk about these all day, but I'm not going to do that because I don't want to take up any more of our speakers' time. We have saved some time at the end for questions, so please hold your questions until the end, until all speakers have finished. And also, we are recording this session, so we will try to repeat the questions as they're asked. I don't believe that there's a microphone floating around. Is there? Okay, so we'll just try to repeat the questions as they're asked. Our first speaker is Eric Porchot. Eric is the Professional Development Director at the American Institute for Conservation of Historic and Artistic Works, otherwise known as AIC. This is the National Membership Organization for Conservation Professionals. He was hired in 2001 to initiate a program of professional development, which now features workshops on a variety of topics offered throughout the United States. Current projects include developing new curricula for the profession and implementing e-learning and blended learning. Eric previously was a faculty member at Long Island University and Old Dominion University. He holds a doctorate in theater and a master's of business administration. He has taught arts management, theater, film, and test preparation in English, as well as windsurfing in Japanese. He has published articles on Romanian theater, including entries for the recently published Oxford Encyclopedia of Theater and Performance. Eric.
I'll have to remember to remove some of those things from my bio in the future. Thank you very much for letting me speak here today. As the short bio indicated, I'm not a conservator nor am I an archivist, but I have had the pleasure of working with education programs, professional development, and continuing education for AIC, including a project that I'm going to talk about today about training responders for cultural emergencies. We're sort of easing you into PowerPoint today. There is a handout that I have that has our logo on it, but it doesn't correspond with the slides. The slides are pretty pictures for you to watch while I talk. But the real meat of the information would be in the handout. So today we're talking about a new resource that's available to you and other institutions for disaster response and recovery. And there were many, many people involved with this. As I said, I'm just one piece in terms of the training program that we've set up. But what I'm talking about is really the result of a lot of hours and hours and many, many people within AIC and without. AIC, the American Institute for Conservation, is sort of your sister organization. Our members are conservation professionals. They handle everything from stamps to cemeteries, from the Star Spangled Banner to the Statue of Liberty, and on down to Grandma's wedding photos. Our foundation, FAIC, is a sister organization that supports education, publication, research, and service to collecting institutions and the general public. And AIC and its members do have a fairly long history of providing assistance to collecting institutions following disasters. There we go. And as you know, disasters come in all shapes and sizes, from a leaking sprinkler head to region-wide hurricanes, floods, and earthquakes. And fortunately, disasters are relatively rare, but that also means that most institutions and individuals have little experience with disaster situations. You certainly hope you don't have to live through more than one in your lifetime. So who do you call on help? Who do you call on to help you or your institution? And likewise, the local, state, and federal emergency response agencies are focused on saving lives, preserving public health, making sure buildings are safe, and saving stuff, if I can use a technical term, is rightfully a very low priority for these emergency response agencies and may not even be in their mandate at all. So therefore, there's a real need, I think, for collecting institutions to create their own infrastructure, their own resources for support following a disaster. And as I'm sure you're aware, good planning, along with prompt and informed response, means better and faster recovery for the collections, for the buildings that they're in, and for the organizations that are able to get back up on their feet again more quickly. And so the AIC Collections Emergency Response Training Project was designed to help collecting institutions with expertise and assistance, either in person or by telephone. Now, conservators were very actively involved in the response to the hurricanes of 2005. Over 220 AIC members volunteered to assist. Now, not all of them were actually able to be used. And we worked with AASLH and other organizations to get expertise to areas where it was most needed. One of the teams, after much difficulty, since street signs and landmarks were often wiped out, found what you see there on the screen. This is a historic society in Mississippi. And basically, the two photos are taken from the same angle. You can see the building in the background. That frame building survived somehow. But the historic society in the foreground was gone, except for the vault. So you can see that there was a real shock, I guess. And the idea of coming in and helping salvage collections in this case was a little optimistic, to be sure. But we did learn some lessons from this experience, the whole activities following Katrina. There was definitely a need for common training, for an approach, a way of working that everybody would share, a need for better coordination with the civil authorities, and also better coordination and communication with the collecting institutions. They need to be ready to receive help. If they're still worrying about their grandmother in the hospital and there's nobody there to meet you on site, then it's too early. And that was one of the things that we learned. A better understanding of insurance and government resources available to institutions. Better training in health and safety concerns. And better screening of volunteers. As I said, we had 220 people who signed up on a website saying we're ready to help, but we didn't really have a way to sort those people back out again by specialty, by experience, by training. And likewise, a need for a current database of contacts and expertise, which we put together after the fact, but would have been much better to have had current and ready to go before the actual need. And of course, money for supplies, for travel expenses. And lastly, we saw a need for a better consistency of assessment and condition reports, the ability to recall those and store them on an as-needed basis. So based on those needs, the foundation of the American Institute for Conservation applied for a grant from the Institute of Museum and Library Services. And we received the funding late in 2006 for training that's taking place this year. The project will train 61 professionals, people with collections backgrounds. And this includes not only conservators, but also archivists, librarians, collection care specialists. And it ends up they're coming from 29 different states. This is our group from Charleston that we trained this spring. And we did set up some prerequisites. People had to have inoculations for tetanus, hepatitis A and B, or immunity. They had to have an OSHA-approved respirator fit test, and also complete the incident command training that FEMA offers as an online course, as well as available as in person as well. We looked for experience, for previous training, and the willingness to respond to disasters. We also looked for a wide variety of skills, expertise, and geography, hoping that we'd have people nearby. Just curious, is anybody here has been accepted into this program? Because somebody in the back. Oh, great. Because I don't know everybody by face. I have them in the database only. And when we set up the training, we had several different goals. We wanted it to be consistent so that everybody received the same information, heard the same message. We are team teaching this. We have a team of 3 instructors, and there are 5 additional presenters. So there's, again, a wide range of skills and outlooks on this. It's a 1-week training program and focused on simulations, both phone simulations and a hands-on, on-site simulation. You see people walking down the streets of Charleston with their gear on. It includes a lot of information on health and safety, both for the team members and for people who are still working in the collections. A lot of incident command training, just how to organize, how to keep information flowing safely and efficiently. Teamwork development. Hopefully when these people meet again in a more stressful situation, they'll already have some bond, some ability to work together. And bringing in the knowledge of resources, including speakers from commercial disaster response firms who address each of the workshop participants. Now, we don't actually cover a lot of recovery techniques, partly because there's not enough time, but also the idea was we're bringing in people with materials experience to begin with, people who know paper, who know photographs, who know wooden artifacts, who know lighthouses. We don't expect everybody to be able to react to every situation. But there is an overview, and we rely, of course, heavily on some of the materials that my fellow speakers have been developing. There are more details on the curriculum, by the way, in the handout if you're curious. Each participant gets a go kit. It's a backpack on wheels, with wheels, a helmet that's with the AIC CERT logo on it that's blue like the UN. We thought that was appropriate. And a reflective vest, again, with the logos for easy identification. They'll also have an ID card once we've confirmed that they've finished all the requirements for training. And they also get equipped with assessment tools, which is not only a form, but a database, so that there's a consistent way of describing situations. So we completed the 1 session already in May in Charleston, South Carolina. We have 2 more coming up shortly, in October in West Virginia, and in November in Seattle. As I said, the selections have already been made. We filled the 61 places. We received 106 applications, and the result is that AIC will have a group of people that we can certify with a lowercase c as meeting requirements as responders. So where do we go next? Having that pool of trained people is just one component for effective response. There are areas still to be developed in this project. Funding. We need to be able to support supplies, travel expenses, and continued training, not only for the existing pool of the team members, but also to bring new responders into the pool. We need to create a better database with all that current contact information, specialties, experience, expertise. And a big part of it is communication. There are a lot of stakeholders out there, and it's too late to wait until something happens to get the word out that we have this project. So what does all this mean to you? Well, please help us get the word out that this program exists. The Collections Emergency Response Team is a resource that certainly can be used by you and your colleagues, and it's certainly not the only resource out there. We're working closely with other members of the National Heritage Emergency Task Force, convened by Heritage Preservation, which you'll hear more about in a moment. And we're also creating an action plan to keep in touch with a variety of government and non-government organizations. And the slides show some of these stakeholders. In the government, at various levels, you have people like FEMA, Department of the Interior, the State and Tribal and Historic and State Historic Preservation Officers, a growing number of regional disaster response groups where collecting organizations in a geographic area have banded together to provide mutual support in the event of disaster. Associations such as SAA and COSA and Heritage Preservation and AAM, ALA, AASLH, and their similar regional and state entities like the Southeast Museums Conference or NEDCC. And then obviously we need communication with the collecting institutions themselves, the museums, the libraries, the archives, the historic sites. And our program then needs to be able to respond on a variety of levels and scales, from the leaky sprinkler on up to a regional, region-wide hurricane or earthquake type of event. And it's very important then that we keep spreading the word to cultural institutions and support groups before the need arises. It's a big task. We're just beginning to address one little corner of the total need, and we welcome your suggestions, your comments, and your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Eric. Next we have Jane Long. Just going to pull up her. Jane S. Long is the Vice President for Emergency Programs at the nonprofit Heritage Preservation in Washington, D.C. She has served as Director of the Heritage Emergency National Task Force since it was formed in 1995 by Heritage Preservation, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and the Getty Conservation Institute. Jane has provided leadership for all of Heritage Preservation's disaster initiatives, from the Emergency Response and Salvage Wheel to the innovative Alliance for Response project, an award-winning field guide to emergency response. She is co-author of Heritage Preservation's Caring for Your Family Treasures. Jane has served as Special Projects Coordinator for the President's Committee on the Arts and the Humanities and Executive and Executive Director of the Foundation for Public Affairs. She holds a BA degree from the College of Worcester in Ohio and an MA from the University of Chicago. Jane?
Thank you all very much. It's good to be here today, and I'm hoping that after you hear all of the presentations, we titled our panel Learning the Hard Way, National Preparedness Initiatives, and I'm hoping that by the time you hear all of these presentations, you'll think we should have changed it to No Excuses. I think that there are so many resources now available to all of you that ought to be able to help if you don't have a plan to get you going with one. I also am going to be talking about another important aspect of preparedness today, which is cooperation. And I just discovered, although I have been to SAA meetings before and I know how helpful everyone is, I just discovered that this could be like carrying coals to Newcastle. I made a dash down to the ladies' room right before this started, and as you know, one of the sets of restrooms is closed, and there was a huge line, and it was 5 minutes before the presentation, and I said to the person in front of me in the line, are you aware of any other restrooms that are open? I have to give a presentation in 5 minutes that the session starts, and she said, presenter in the back who has to go. And the message went up the line, and it was fabulous. It was so, if I'm, you know, in case there's a fire, I'm really glad I'm with you. Before I talk about some of the resources that we have available, I want to say just a couple of words about Heritage Preservation, which I represent. We're a nonprofit in Washington, a small one, relatively small. We've been around for 30 years promoting the care of all kinds of collections, whether they're in people's attics or in small towns. We have several major programs that I think you may be familiar with, the Conservation Assessment Program, which is for small museums, the Heritage Emergency Task Force, which I'll talk about in a minute or so, the Heritage Health Index, and Rescue Public Murals, a new project that's an outgrowth of our Save Outdoor Sculpture effort. You will see in the back some materials related to all of these, and I encourage you to pick them up, partly because I won't have to take them home then. We also have a number of publications available, and I have some copies of the Heritage Health Index study for this group, as well as some other publications available in the back. We have something new, and we have a booth. We're very fortunate to have a resource table in the registration area, so you can get more information on all of these if you'll stop by. Now, the Heritage Preservation has been concerned about some of the things in just with the passage of time that cause materials to decay, but we've also been interested in the more swift and catastrophic, or sometimes swift and mundane, causes of damage to archives and museums and libraries. And this, for example, is just from the leaky hot water pipe and damaged about 1,400 cartons of archaeological objects in Santa Fe a couple of years ago. It was because of this interest in disasters that affect collections, whether they're caused by mundane leaky pipes or something as widespread as Katrina, that caused us to form the Heritage Emergency National Task Force. It's a loosely allied coalition. Heritage Preservation serves as the secretariat. If many of you, I'm sure, work for nonprofit organizations, you understand that our role of secretariat grows and diminishes as with available funds and staff. But we've been hanging together now for 10 years, more than 10 years. We have 41 members, including SAA, the Council of State Archivists, NARA. We're a blend of both national nonprofits and federal agencies. These are our products. I'm not going to run through the whole list because I'm going to be talking about some of the products and projects as I move through my talk. The task force itself has a special URL, heritageemergency.org, and I would encourage you to visit it. There are a lot of resources available that we'll discuss in just a few minutes. The wheel rolls on. I did meet someone this morning who had not seen the wheel before, so I'm glad I included this slide. We are now doing, we've just completed, in fact, a second printing of the latest edition, which was in 2005. This was originally published with funds from the National Endowment for the Humanities. It's been published in 6 languages, and I think one of the greatest things about it, yes, it has magnets and all those things, it was, when it first came out, read and approved by at least 35 professional conservators. So you have some idea, it's maybe the most concise thing ever published by a committee. And the award-winning field guide, I'm sorry, which you'll be hearing about later, has just been out a year. The advantage of the field guide, I think the wonderful thing about it, is people in preservation had been saying to us all along, we need something that's a step between the wheel and a big plan. And it also acknowledges the fact that even people who make an effort to make a plan, if you're hit with a disaster, you're often panicked at the beginning, and the field guide helps you through the first steps. There's also a DVD. I think this is the first time we've had Disaster Response, the movie, other than the training videos. And you can actually see some best practices techniques. This was also funded through NEH, for which we're very grateful. And we had a lot of fun making it. We're very proud of it. The other area where Heritage Preservation and the task force have been active is the area of cooperation with professional emergency responders. This is a picture, by the way, from the fire at the Georgetown Library in Washington, D.C. This is one of the conservation volunteers speaking with a member of the D.C. Fire Department. Why do we need to know the professional emergency managers? In any major event that involves life safety, they're going to be in charge, which sometimes, for those of us in the cultural community, is a surprise, because we're sort of used to being in charge of things and being organized. But in a disaster, it's going to be somebody else. There are already frameworks in place, and this is one of the things that people who are taking the AIC course are learning. At all levels of government, we also know that a crisis is not the time to exchange business cards for the first time. And we're finding, too, that emergency managers in your community can be a good resource for planning. They know about the risks in your community. They may know about some resources that you weren't aware of. Because of all these needs, we formed a program called Alliance for Response. We've had forums that bring together emergency managers and representatives of the cultural communities and their neighbors to talk about how they can work together and be prepared in the future. We've had successful forums in 7 cities, and if you check our website, you'll find that there are still committees active in those cities. If you're from any of them, you can get involved. the program went well enough that the California Office of Emergency Services sponsored their own regional forums last fall, and this spring they had four in each set. And Heritage Preservation is in the last stages of publishing a handbook for communities on how to plan these forums. We're also seeking more funding because we'd like to not only give people handbooks, but a little financial incentive, because it's a lot of work to get these organized. This is my pitch also to remind you that not all collections are in institutions. People with preservation experience and knowledge can be very helpful after disasters. We know of libraries who keep a copy of The Wheel on their front desk. And we have on our website links to a lot of good sources, the Minnesota Historical Society and others, with sound information. There's unfortunately some bad information out there about how you can dry out the family Bible in the microwave. We don't recommend that. And we also have a very simple news release called Save Your Treasures the Right Way. So when you're thinking about your own archives, think about how what you know can help the public as well. The last set of resources I want to talk about result from a project that the task force has been working on since last fall. As Aimee mentioned in her presentation, a lot of organizations were thinking about the lessons learned after Katrina. We were too. We got some funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Bay and Paul Foundations to do a lessons learned project, and we thought everybody else is doing such a good job thinking about lessons learned that maybe we can think about how to apply those lessons. So the 41 task force members got together and they divided themselves into panels. We sort of thought these define the major areas of learning after Katrina. And we charged the task force members with coming up over, in about 8 months' time, five short-term resources or to meet five short-term goals that would result in resources for the field, and then to develop some longer-term recommendations. I'm not going to talk about the longer-term recommendations today just because of the limits on time, but I do want to let you know about some short-term resources that have resulted from the task force efforts. Now, one of them I know as SAA members you're all familiar with, and that is May Day. And what we did was take the original Society of American Archivists concept, which was so popular and successful, and just expand it for all types of institutions. We promoted it to a broader number of institutions and have available on our website a logo that can apply to museums, libraries, historic sites. We're encouraging, as you know, people to undertake one simple task. And I'm asking you, and I know SAA would appreciate it too, if you've done anything for May Day, whether it's filled out your prep form, which you'll hear about from Vicki, or just found out where your fire extinguisher is, if you'd let us know at taskforce@heritagepreservation.org, I'd appreciate it. We also have developed, and I have copies for the people who have been good enough to come to our session, tips for working with emergency responders. This little sheet will tell you where to find them, how to build relationships with them, and what they need to know about your institution or your archives that will help you when disaster strikes. There's one tip that I learned recently at one of our Alliance for Response meetings that I'd never thought about before, and this was already published and we didn't include it, but there's a museum in the Philadelphia area that has offered both its restrooms and its parking lot to the local police commander, and that's turned out to be a very helpful relationship. So there are all sorts of simple tips like that you can do to get to know the firefighters, the police, and the local emergency managers in your area. We have a list of recommended professional emergency management training. There's lots of training out there for cultural heritage professionals about salvage and preparedness. But these are free online courses that have to do with the larger framework that I mentioned earlier. You can find out about these existing frameworks. You can learn the lingo that the emergency managers use, and you can earn a vest. So if you can't go to one of the AIC seminars, you can check out some of these online courses. We also have a guide to navigating FEMA and SBA disaster aid. If any of you have suffered a major disaster, you know that working your way through the bureaucracy can be pretty tough. We have on our website now this tool to help you through the process and gets links right at your fingertips. We're also looking for a little funding to publish this and send it out after disasters happen. So disasters will happen, large or small. I guess that's our basic message. And I hope that all of you will agree that there are no excuses. Thank you very much.
Okay, so our next speaker, pull up her presentation, is Victoria Irons Walsh. She is the Executive Director of the Council of State Archivists, or COSA. She has worked with COSA since 1992, coordinating a variety of surveys and other projects on state and local archives and records programs. This is kind of appropriate.
They want to come to this session.
Right. including the ongoing Emergency Preparedness Initiative. Independent of her COSA responsibilities, she also served as principal research consultant for the A-Census project of the Society of American Archivists from 2003 to 2007. Earlier, Vicki worked at the Illinois State Archives, the Chicago Historical Society, and the National Archives. She's a fellow of the Society of American Archivists, a certified archivist, and has served as a member of SAA's governing council and as chair of its standards board. Vicki?
Thanks, Meg. Well, it won't come as any surprise that COSA got involved in all of this because of Katrina and Rita, like so many others. Leading up to that point, though, we're very small, as you might imagine. There are 50 state archivists and therefore 50 members. Actually, we also include the District of Columbia and the territories. So 51 active members because D.C. is involved, and we're trying to find those territorial archivists. So if you know them, point them our way. But we're an energetic group, and we're not shy about recruiting state archives staff, as you'll hear, to get involved in our work. Leading up to this, we've been working more closely with the National Archives. It only makes sense that state archives and the National Archives that are all dealing with government records would have a lot in common. But it hadn't always been a relationship that was active. And when Alan Weinstein came in, our board and officers had been working with him a lot and talking with him about a number of things. And in preparing for this, I was trying to remember who made the first call 2 years ago, probably today, to say we've got to do something and how are the states and the National Archives going to help our colleagues in Louisiana and Mississippi. Somehow, delegations got organized that included SAA representatives, COSA members, National Archives representatives, Heritage Preservation, and others to visit in September and November of 2005. Leading up to the second delegation, Alan Weinstein was actually on that one. He happened to be on Air Force One with President Bush, flying to the Reagan Library for an event. And we'd been talking with Alan about how wouldn't it be wonderful if we had statewide preservation plans. We'd done a survey of the state archives in 2004 and said, do you have a statewide plan? And 15 actually said yes, they did. And we thought, well, that's pretty cool. But then when we called them in October of 2005 and said, can you send it to us? We got one. And so there was a little disconnect between what we really knew we needed and what we actually had in place. Anyway, Alan was on the plane going to the Reagan Library and said, by September of 2006, the state archivists will have on your desk 50 statewide disaster plans. And then he came to us and said, guess what I just did? So, He was on his way to Louisiana. He happened to stop in Iowa, where I'm based. My husband, Tim, is a National Archives staffer. He's the director of the Hoover Library. And Alan was stopping at the Hoover for an event before he went to Louisiana to join the delegation. And so we were, the state archivist in Iowa and I were walking with him to lunch when he told us that. So I went running home and got Carl Niederer on the phone, who was going to be seeing Alan the next day, and said, you've got to figure out what he's really done. But the good thing is that it galvanized us. The state archivist came through. We don't have 50 comprehensive statewide disaster plans, and we still don't. We're relying on MA and NEDCC to get us there. But we did a lot of work in the meantime, and it was that partnership with NARA that really got us going. They, and among other things, we repurposed some NHPRC money in an existing grant. NARA gave us some additional, a small amount of additional funding, and then we got a donation from Ancestry.com, actually at that point they were MyFamily.com, to help us as well. So with a relatively small pot of money, we were able to make a lot of progress. This is a list of the principal components of what we've been working on. We started with assessments. We came out with a report based on those assessments. You'll hear more about the Pocket Response Plan. If you haven't been inundated with that information already, I'll inundate you some more. We're working on developing training for state and local governments. And the most important thing that waves through all of this is establishing and sustaining the relationships we need and that the state archives and all of the rest of us need to do emergency preparedness and response. This was the first section, the first piece. We had a small but mighty team, two preservation administrators, Maria Holden from the New York State Archives and Christine Wiseman from the Georgia Archives, were really the heart of this team, who led the initial effort in developing the first products of the Emergency Response Initiative. As I said, we're not shy about drafting good staff, and they were wonderful to work with. The first thing we needed to know was what current conditions were. How can you do a plan if you don't know where you stand? This didn't just look at the state archives. It did, the first part of it did look at their preparedness, but they also were asked, the state archives were also asked to say, how are the state and local agencies in your state prepared? How well for records-related emergencies, and what kinds of services are available to nonprofit or non-government and cultural organizations statewide. That was the smallest piece. Some state archives have the capability of providing those kinds of services. Others don't. And so, as somebody said, May, I think, every state is so different. We were trying to do something that would work for all of them. There were about 225 criteria in the assessment. I believe that assessment tool could easily be adapted to other kinds of repositories. It's available on our website for download. You're welcome to pull it down and use it, see if you can adapt it for your own work. I would think it would be especially useful for a local government application. As you might expect, we really have focused on government records. That's our bailiwick and where our strengths are. One of the great discoveries, not great, horrible discoveries we made coming into this is that the National Response Plan, the governing document that drives all responses by FEMA and everybody else, did not include records as an asset. It included historic structures and it included cultural works, I believe, but not records. So when the National Archives needed to go in and assess the condition of federal records, the National Archives staff had to ride along in the boats with the General Services Administration as they were going building to building. And they were that was not mandated because records weren't part of the plan. I do have a copy of the assessment that you can do. We've got a resource table right next to Heritage Preservation, so come visit both of us, and we have a number of these tools down there. On your chairs when you came in, I hope you found a copy of this. There's the report. This is the report that came out of the assessment. We published 20,000 of these with our support, mostly from my family.
And our goal is to get it into the hands of every congressman, every state legislator, and every governor. We're getting there. And we also have it available. The good news is that other people are starting to pick it up. Within the last couple, 3 months, I've had orders from the Baraboo Wisconsin Public Library. I'm not sure who they're giving it to, but more power to them. Federal Executive Board in New Mexico ordered copies, so they're using them to make the case for federal government preparedness. And a city clerk from a suburb in Detroit, in the Detroit area, ordered 11 copies to take to her city council to make the case for better preparedness. So we're finding that it's got applicability way beyond state archives, and we're delighted that it's getting used for those purposes. The other good thing about this is that now that we've got their attention using this tool and others, we've been able to take them past to why they need to prepare for emergencies to why do they need to have a good archives and records management program in the first place. So we're backing up, and we've got this mantra about why records matter. And there are four reasons, we say: to protect life, to protect property, to protect rights, and to restore order following an emergency. Protecting life in terms of medical records and infrastructure, protecting property, deeds and plats and insurance records. This particular photo, this is from upstate New York during the flooding last June. This is one of the ones that when we show this to a local government officials, they stop and pay attention because they can visualize their file room with water pouring in the window. That's one of the ones that really gets them. Protecting rights, and then the continuity of operations is the other place where we've really been able to get the governments to sit up and listen. This photo is the cause of the most hits that our website has ever received. A blogger, not an archivist blogger, but just a blogger out there, found this photo. It's the Waveland City Hall. All that was left were the concrete steps after Katrina blew through. And so how do you get your city going again when you don't even have a building, much less anything that used to be in the building? FEMA, through the National Archives, we were able to connect with the FEMA Continuity of Operations Division. The director is Rex Wamsley. He used to be a state emergency manager in Nebraska, so he understands state government. He understands the importance of records for the continuity of operations. He was the first to realize, really, that records were not included in their training programs. And so he came to NARA and came to us and said, help us build records into our own training programs. And then we began to talk about, well, how are we going to, he's doing training for federal officials. How can we get the training out for state and local officials? NARA has some wonderful training already in emergency preparedness and vital records, vital as in essential records. And we've applied for a grant to another division in FEMA that I'll tell you about in a little bit. We're hoping to get that working. This has also opened doors for us with local government associations. We've also got a major project, an NHPRC-funded project on local government archives, and there's a lot of natural intersections between these two. As part of that project, we drew in representatives from a number of local government associations and showed them this report, and all of a sudden they're buying into the program. One of them, the International City County Management Association, asked us to prepare a series of four articles for their journal, starting with emergency preparedness, but then building to the value of good records management and archives. The lead article was written by the assistant county manager for Montgomery County, Maryland, who sat through that and listened to this, to our cases, and said, this is important and I need to tell my colleagues about it. So it's building on this, it's, you know, raising the alarm by using emergencies, but then taking it the next step. Okay, this is our fun little tool. The Pocket Response Plan, if you haven't seen it, this was our attempt to take your basic repository response plan in a low-tech way and make it portable. There is a template for this on our website. all of the state archives, supposedly, I've seen most of them, have done one of these for their own staff. On one side, it's got contact information, so when your power goes out and your cell phone towers don't work, you can still figure out a way to find everybody. On the opposite side, flip side, it's the first steps to take in the first 24 to 72 hours after you have an emergency. It's low, deliberately low-tech. We sell little Tyvek envelopes that are water-resistant, not waterproof, so you can put it in your wallet and it won't self-destruct on its own just for wear and tear. So we have our own templates for the state archives that I know have already been adapted for local governments. WestPass, the new program for the western states, Julie Page has already adapted one of these for repositories generally. We're going to be able to put up a link to that or her template within the next couple of weeks, so watch for that. This template, again, is available on our site for download. Let's see. I'm operating. I've had my own little emergency. I broke my wrist 4 weeks ago, and I said when I went into the hospital, I said, can I have one of those orange casts so at least I match my report when I go? Be prepared. One of the other things that, as we keep talking about this, David Carmichael, the state archivist in Georgia, thank you, was president of COSA when all of this broke, and he's continued to be very involved. About 3 or 4 weeks ago, he emailed me and said, I've been tinkering over the weekend. And David, if anybody knows him, he's that kind of person who just kind of comes up with things out of the blue, but they're always good. We'd been talking about preparing families and individuals. You might know that the state archives all have state historical records advisory boards that are part of the NHPRC records program, work very often with small repositories throughout their states, do a lot of public awareness, get involved in Archives Week and Month activities, things like that. So work a lot with individuals and communities. And Georgia has a particularly active SHRAB. And so he'd gotten interested in helping individuals and families with their records. So he's got this draft, and we're going to figure out how to publish it. So watch for this. But it's also, I think, a matter of making sure your own staff members are prepared personally, because I don't think we can help our institutions unless we know our families are okay when something happens. We know about May Day, and we're all pushing that in the states as well as every place else. But September is National Preparedness Month, and I hadn't really focused on that until a few months ago. I give you their website. They have a kit that you can download, but it's a way to connect with community and statewide and national programs. So if you become aware, or if you want to do something and hook in with the National Preparedness Month activities. We're turning into entrepreneurs to keep our things afloat. We're offering a discount on our preps and on our reports through the end of September, actually, instead of just September 7th. I said that we were working on training for state and local governments. We've applied for a major grant from FEMA, and I don't know, we made it through the first cut. It's a 50-50 chance, basically, based on how many are on file and will be approved. We will be hearing in the next 2 or 3 months, but we've been working very closely with the National Archives on this. We sent about 10 or 15 state archives employees into the NARA training program to test it and say, will this apply to state and local governments? And they came back and said, absolutely. There are some adaptations, some additional material you need to understand what the laws are in your own state or jurisdiction. But for the most part, it will apply very easily. We wanted to make them as accessible as possible. Local governments have a great deal of trouble traveling any distance. So it would be largely web-based or self-directed CDs. We would do regional training programs, train teams of 5 people from each state. We're including the state IT people and the state emergency managers, along with the state archives and records managers. The other thing we know is that, I'm going to flip through these real fast, it's all about relationships. Well, I told you that we went to meet with Rex Wamsley, the director of the COOP division at FEMA, early in February of 2006. he walked in the room and the first thing he said to us was, it's all about relationships. And we didn't fully understand it then, but we sure do now. The connection to them and the connection to NARA and the connection to the other people on this panel and SAA and everyone else, it's all about setting up those connections so that when the emergency happens, you have your partners in place and you're ready to respond. I think that's it.
Thank you, Victor.
Thank you, all of our speakers. And we've got a good amount of time for questions. Any of you have any questions? Yes, Tom?
Eric, I know that in the late 90s, there was some training that AIC, through the National Endowment for the Humanities, put together for training responders. And then there was some work in the field. I think there were probably 60 to 90 people that program as well. Is there any possibility that people from that earlier program and this current program could be mixed together, or how will those programs match?
I just wanted to repeat the question to Eric about their previous sort of train the trainers program and how that's going to combine with this new program that AIC is doing.
I'm really very glad that you brought that up, because I was going to include that in my talk, and I thought, that's just too complicated, and nobody will ever remember it anyway. So, forgetting that I'm speaking to archivists, of course. Yes, they do actually mesh very well. We contacted as many of those people as we could track down. That was it was in the late 90s. It was an NEH-funded program that we called Train the Trainers. We trained 10 people who went out and then trained, I forget what the grand total was, 60 or 70 more. And so as many of those people as we still had addresses or contact information for, we sent them a special invitation asking them to look for this particular training. That training did deal a little more heavily with materials and recovery. This one is much more about structure and, you know, assisting at the organizational level more than the hands-on getting your hands wet with paper or oil paintings or whatever. So yes, this really was an outgrowth. A lot of what we learned from that program, we applied into this one. In fact, the three key instructors were all, let's see, two of them were instructors were from that program, Mary Jo Davis and Barbara Moore. And I think Teresa Vollinger was also a graduate from that program.
So, Eric, is the training going to be offered again after this year?
Unknown. We're still in the middle of the current project. It is there's no revenue from it at all, so it's completely supported by grants and by the volunteered time of the people who are engaged in it. I think we will need to train more people over the years, but we haven't gotten that far yet.
And the second question about relating to emergency responders, is that directed to everyone? Emergency management agencies? Is that geared towards everyone? Is that Gregor? Or?
Well, I was targeting there, but it can apply to all. Maybe to clarify, if I make a comment.
Sure.
In Massachusetts, after the blizzard of 1978, the legislature passed an executive order, created what is known as the Massachusetts Emergency Management Team that exists. We meet on a monthly basis. It involves state agencies, all of whom would be involved with the disaster, and a lot of other agencies, the Coast Guard, the Air National Guard, National Guard, State Police, etc. And for the last 10 years, we've had people representing cultural resources. So everybody gets to know each other. And the cultural resources get on the table at an early stage rather than at the last minute or at the hindsight. So the question I have is, and I know this was a major problem, I'm following Katrina, that the cultural heritage community and the emergency management community were going in opposite directions. They didn't know the other one existed. And so my question, I guess, goes to the fact is there an active process by which the states are going to get involved with the emergency management?
I can speak for some of these relationships that we're building already. FEMA and NARA and COSA together have organized a series of regional phone calls, conference calls, led by the National Archives and or FEMA regional offices for the states in their regions. They have been happening quarterly. We're now in our second quarter of calls, and they include the state archives, state records management office, if it's not part of the state archives, the state emergency manager, or their office, and the state information technology staff. And that was our call. Originally it was just going to be the archives, and the National Archives and FEMA, of course. But we said you've got to have the IT people in there too, because that's where the records are, the current ones. And so that was good. So that's put the state archives in contact with the IT people as well as the state emergency managers. In the first round of calls, there were any number where the state archivists were meeting the state emergency management officers for the first time on the phone. But now we know that at least in 45 of the 50 states, they've at least introduced themselves. When we did our assessment, there were maybe three or four states, Maria, do you remember, where the state archivist had ever met the state emergency manager. We know that's changed. And so that's encouraging. Now, this doesn't take the next step. It helps with the government records level. So now we've taken care of, the government, state and local governments. But it doesn't necessarily incorporate the cultural. And that's a different effort or the next step or something.
There are a couple of things that Heritage Preservation and the Task Force have done in this area. The Alliance for Response project that I made reference to is an effort through some model meetings to encourage people in the cultural heritage community, defined broadly, to work more closely with their local responders. And the most recent Alliance for Response forums, actually the Boston area, building on the work that Gregor was involved with years ago, still has a committee meeting called CEMENT, which regularly, the Cultural Emergency Management Team, which is an ongoing effort. And the most recent forums we've had in Atlanta and Philadelphia both have follow-up groups which are meeting next month. And the Philadelphia forum took place only in June, and they're already following up. Atlanta was earlier this year, and their September meeting is going to be their second follow-up effort. And they're the Heritage Emergency, Heritage Emergency Response Association. That's not quite right. Brenda, do you know the name of the new group?
I'll stumble it.
All right. That's close enough. There are a couple other efforts that are going on. I mentioned some longer-term activities that the task force undertook as part of its Lessons Applied initiative. Tom Clarison was the chair of a panel on working with emergency responders. And that group developed the tip sheet, which is available here. That was the short-term resource. But we're also, as Gregor pointed out, this is a long process. It was like many of you may be old enough to remember the public information campaign on behalf of high blood pressure. I sort of feel like this is a long haul to get people in the emergency management community. It's not that they don't like museums and libraries and archives. It's just not on the radar scope. And one of the things that this particular panel on working with emergency responders is doing is trying to raise that level of visibility. And our first step forward is that the International Association of Emergency Managers, which is the International Association of the local folks, is having their annual meeting, and for the first time there's going to be a panel on cultural and historic assets in communities and how important it is to protect them. That's coming up in November. So we're sort of chipping away and trying to get involved in other projects, both on the national level as well as helping people at the local level just through simple tips, go up to the to the local fire station and say, hi, want to come and see my archives?
Well, and Jane, the other thing that happened, and I think it was your work with John Ketchum and our work with Rex Wamsley, both who work for FEMA, John primarily on the cultural side and Rex on the COOP side, finally met each other.
That's right.
So, you know, you come at it from all angles.
That's right. And FEMA's also, for a while, they've been, needless to say, preoccupied with Katrina recovery in the section of FEMA that deals with historic and cultural resources. But they're going back there. They have the funding, and they're going back to continue to develop. We've had one session to help them develop the outline of a curriculum to train the emergency managers in cultural heritage interests, and they're now going to go ahead and take the outline of that and develop a full curriculum. So that's another step in the right direction.
Great. Do you have a question right here?
Yeah, I like the idea of the rapid responders for cultural items. I guess I'm wondering, in future, what would be the system by which those rapid responders would be called, and who's going to pay for them to go to an emergency site and deal with that? I guess we're used to seeing firemen come from all over the state or the country to a grass fire. How do we deal with these kind of cultural emergency response?
So, question to Eric about who's going to pay for, how do we sort of dispatch all of these cultural responders?
That is something we're still developing, and I think we will probably end up doing a combination of things. I mean, part of the strategy as it's developing is that some of the cost is going to need to be borne by the region, the state, the community, the organization being helped. But we do realize that we also need a pot of money, basically, that will get people into an area very quickly, give them the supplies they need, the travel. And that is to be developed. In Katrina and Rita, those conservators donated their time a week at a time, then they rotated teams in, but there were still expenses, obviously. And the other part of this that we're looking at is realistically a disaster on the scale of Katrina, we hope, is not going to happen all that many times, that most of the response that our teams will be dealing with would be much smaller, single institution, maybe a single town, not the kind of area-wide problem that we saw on the Gulf Coast. So the short answer is we're still working on that part, but it's the key question, because unless we can deploy quickly and accurately, then this is all wasted effort.
The other thing we've become aware of in state government that's available is something called EMAC, the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, that basically all 50 states have signed on to, that allows state government employees to cross state lines, continue to be paid by their home agency, their insurance stays the same, so there's none of that red tape paperwork. But they can go if there's, you know, and it's specifically to send people with certain kinds of expertise. So a state could say, I need help with paper conservation, and if there's a state archives that can send somebody, then, and you know, and is willing to donate the time, I suppose that becomes the issue. But there is this compact in place, so we just need to exercise it if we can. Yes.
From the
state.
Exactly. The other thing that is for training that is a possibility.
I also wanted to mention we were talking about sort of this relationship between emergency responders and cultural heritage staff, and in our statewide initiative, there are three different sort of topics that it's hopefully going to run through the whole guide, and that is key relationships, communication, and cooperation. So that's also something that we're, you know, Vicki was talking about the state level. We're also thinking about that on a statewide level as well.
Actually, the one of the sessions at connecting to collections dealt with emergency resources. Absolutely. And for a long time, in fact, I think the first person I heard say this was Hillary Kaplan from the National Archives. It talked about how preservation and disaster preparedness fit so perfectly together because they're really both about preventing loss. So at the Connecting to Collections Summit, there was not only there was a session about disaster preparedness, but also the Archivist of the United States talked about his experience after the flood there last summer. And although a good recovery was made, what a devastating experience that is. There are plans. I'm not that familiar with the statewide planning grants. I know that the IMLS booth tomorrow is going to have information available. But absolutely, there. I know the agency is interested in that. We actually have another initiative called REP. We started out calling it PREP, independently of Vicki's, that we're just getting started, called the Risk Evaluation and Planning Program. It's modeled on our conservation assessment program, and it'll be in a. We're just doing a. It's a model project, a pilot that we're doing in three states. Five museums each, because it's through the museum division of IMLS, and we're going to be doing an assessment not just of the, it's going to be focused on emergency managers, so there'll be a CAP assessor in the sense there'll be a professor, a preservation professional, but also a public safety officer or other emergency management professional paired with the preservation specialist to go into the institution, look at their risks and help them to plan, and that was something that IMLS is interested in seeing how that all works out. So yes, I would say emergencies, that's a topic of interest to them.
We have any more questions? Okay, thank you for coming, and thank you to our speakers.